From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this week. And today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press and the voice of the I Am Boise blog, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Okay, so Betsy, the Idaho Republican Convention is going on right now. It's happening in Twin Falls. Lots of interesting things going on, to say the least. Where shall you begin?
Well, the Associated Press had the first story looking at what are some of the substantive proposals that the conventioners are going to be considering, and noted a proposed resolution denying the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election, one that's similar to one already adopted by the Texas Republican Party, but actually going further and making false claims of election fraud in various states. Interestingly, if the Idaho Republican Party were to say that the 2020 election, presidential election, was fraudulent, they would be saying basically that Trump didn't really win Idaho by 64%. So it's kind of a little counterintuitive. It is one of 31 resolutions that are up for consideration. There are a ton of them, everything from getting rid of the primary in favor of a caucus to select Republican candidates, going after crossover voting, switching municipal elections to be partisan rather than nonpartisan. Now, of course, these resolutions are not binding. These are not laws. These are just the positions of the party. But there are other things that they're considering at this convention as well. Kind of the biggest thing is, who is their next party chairman? And the current chairman, Tom Luna, is being challenged by State Representative Dorothy Moon, and that'll be a big contest, and the vote will be tomorrow. And then they also have potential changes to the Republican Party platform and to their party rules. And already a committee there has approved a proposed rule change from Brandon Durst. And this is as reported by Clark's colleague, Kelsey Mosley Morris of the Idaho Capital Sun. This proposal is trying to get at crossover voting by essentially blocking anybody from registering as a Republican under a whole array of circumstances, including that they've donated to a candidate from another party within 39 months or 25 months, or they've registered with another party, or they've disaffiliated with the Republican Party, basically just trying to make it so that a whole lot of people could not register as Republicans. And interestingly enough, Brandon Durst, who was an unsuccessful candidate for superintendent of public instruction as a Republican this spring, is a former Democratic legislator. So in some ways, he's going after his own conduct in switching parties and saying that should not be allowed. So it's very interesting stuff that they're looking at.
Okay, so Betsy, I know, as you mentioned, Kelsey Mosley Morris is down covering this in Twin Falls. Can you talk about another article that she has written? And this is about GOP lobbyists are advocating for state-sponsored Christian education.
That's right. Kelsey had a really remarkable story today about one of the featured speakers at the convention who was listed on the agenda. That's Blaine Conzati of the Family Policy Center. And he told a group full of Republican delegates that he essentially believes churches ought to be running public schools. And he hopes to get there. But in the meantime, he wants to take steps towards that. And he believes that public education should be Christian. And in some ways, this dovetails with another proposed platform change that was proposed by Scott Herndon, who is currently a candidate for the state Senate after defeating an incumbent in the Republican primary. Herndon's proposal would add to the preamble of the Republican Party platform a statement that we are Republicans because we accept the Lord Jesus Christ as our Savior. So essentially disqualifying as a Republican in Idaho anyone of any other religion. In other words, no Jewish Republicans, no Muslim Republicans, none of that would be allowed. Now, this is not really where either the U.S. Constitution or the Idaho Constitution generally points. It's kind of an un-American concept that there would be an established religion and anyone who wasn't of that religion would be denied voting or participation rights. So it's It's an interesting trend that we're seeing toward essentially Christian theocracy as a platform plank or a position of the Idaho Republican Party. Now, none of this has been approved yet. Anything even that comes out of a committee at the convention still would need to go to the full convention floor. And there are 700 and some delegates who would vote on them. But it is not uncommon for some fairly far-reaching and even extreme planks to end up in the Idaho Republican Party platform. The current Idaho Republican Party platform, before any changes, calls for the repeal of the 17th Amendment, which established direct election of U.S. senators, to instead turn that back to state legislators, taking away the ability of the people to elect their own U.S. senators. That's in the current platform. So is opposition to all abortion, including in cases of rape and incest. So who knows what we're going to see come out of this? And it does matter what a party sets as its platform and its rules and its resolutions. It tells you where that party stands, and it governs and sets the stage for political interactions within members of that party. And of course, this is a party that very much dominates Idaho politics. The Republicans hold every single statewide office, every single seat in our congressional delegation, and more than 80% of seats in the Idaho legislature.
And what's interesting about this, Betsy, though, is like you said, I mean, yes, they can put this in their platform, right? And it does show you overreaching what those beliefs of that party is. Yet at the same time, it goes against, the Constitution. I mean, for example, let's just take this idea that they want churches to run public schools. That's unconstitutional. That's called a private school. There are private religious schools. Pay for it. Send your kid there.
Right. And the Idaho Constitution actually goes much further than even the U.S. Constitution on this, strictly forbidding any expenditure of public funds for religious education. That is exactly what Kanzati was calling for in his speech.
Wow. All right. Let's move on to some other things. And I know that all three of you have covered this issue, and it's what's going on in the lieutenant governor's office right now. So I'd like to hear from everyone, but Clark, maybe set us up, because Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan is giving a staffer a raise. Normally, this would not make news headlines. Somebody gets a raise. What's the big deal?
Yeah, I think, Gemma, this is really interesting. And like you said, all of us have been covering Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan and her budget for a while now. But I think the interesting things about this raise are the timing of the raise, who's getting it, the politically connected former assistant who's getting the raise, and then the amount of the raise. And so the timing's important, but Idaho runs, they call it a fiscal year. You can kind of think of it as a budget year. And Idaho's fiscal year begins on July 1st every year and runs through June 30th. So we're just now at the very beginning of a new fiscal year. And I know that a lot of listeners today will remember that Lieutenant Governor McGeehan just narrowly avoided running a budget deficit in her office in the fiscal year that ended on June 30th. The state had to take all these steps, including pausing vendor payments, deferring her salary into the next budget year because she had legal fees and wasn't able to manage her budget. So the brand new budget for the state of Idaho, 2023 budget, kicks in just a couple of weeks ago on July 1st, and effective that day, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan approved a promotion and an 85% pay increase to a former temporary part-time administrative assistant whose name is Michelle Hamilton, who happens to be the vice chair of the Idaho Republican Party. Obviously, Janice McGeehan is a Republican. She ran unsuccessfully for governor in the May 17th primary elections. But I think the timing of this coming almost immediately after she nearly ran a budget deficit in the previous year, the fact that it's coming to a political ally, a politically connected Republican operative, party official, and the fact that it's 85%, the dollarly pay increase for Michelle Hamilton is going from $20 an hour to $37 an hour at a full-time position, which pencils out to be right at about $77,000 a year if you're extrapolating out an hourly pay rate to what a salary is. And this is really interesting because Janice McGeehan lost her primary election for governor. She's not running for lieutenant governor, so she's going to be out of office come January. And this decision is raising all kinds of questions about how much funding will be available for the next lieutenant governor who Idahoans elect in November, who will take office in January, midway through the budget year. I talked to Terry Pickens-Manweiler, the Democratic nominee who's running for lieutenant governor. She said this is exactly why she's running for office, that this one-party system creates this playing field where there's no consequences for these types of actions. Terry Pickens-Manweiler was very strong and said, in her opinion, this simply amounts to giving a political ally a big kickback funded by the Idaho taxpayers. And Terry Pickens-Manweiler is worried that half of the lieutenant governor's budget could be spent down before the next lieutenant governor takes office. I even got a statement from Republican Speaker of the House, Scott Bedke, the Republican running for lieutenant governor, who made a promise that if he's elected, these types of, quote, questionable decisions won't happen under his watch. So this is something that's raising a lot of eyebrows for the amount of money involved, the huge pay jump. This person is making considerably more than the previously highest paid employee out of that office. And this person will be making more than the lieutenant governor, who has a part-time job in the state of Idaho. And so it's raising a lot of questions, but I know Scott and Betsy have both covered this. And so I'll drop off and let them talk about it and react to the news and see if maybe there's anything I missed.
Well, and Scott, I'd like you to jump in too, because, you know, in an article from the Statesman, not only do your staffers write that this is not typical, I mean, Lieutenant Governor McGeehan is, you know, it's the same rhetoric coming from her. Once it's the media. The media is making a big deal about this.
Right. And Clark did a great job of summing it up. But there are a lot of questions about this. Why would you do this? And there may very well be a reasonable explanation that we could all understand and appreciate. But of course, Lieutenant Governor McGeehan won't speak with the media and answer questions or return phone calls, instead issuing a statement that this is just cooked up by the media and her political enemies, which really, you know, I don't think that really passes the smell test. The facts are the facts. And just like Clark laid out, this is an extraordinary raise and an extraordinary change of position and budget for this office, and just saying that this is you know, fake news by the media and political enemies is just not an acceptable explanation. And we had a good discussion about this with our editorial board, and you know, we said, well, maybe this is kind of like payback to try to get at Scott Bedke, who might be the presumptive lieutenant governor, because he likely, as the Republican, likely will win the general election. But really, the more logical explanation is that it's just rank corruption, that this is just helping your friend get a little more money on your way out the door. Either way, it's not great behavior by a sitting public official.
And right. It's not that often that we have a lame duck public official who essentially has no duties left for the rest of her term in office and decides to spend down the majority of the budget in order to hamper her successor, of whichever party that successor is. The lieutenant governor's position in Idaho is an interesting position in that it kind of has one foot in the executive branch and one foot in the legislative branch. The lieutenant governor presides over the Senate, and then when the legislature is not in session, takes on whatever other duties are assigned by the governor. Lieutenant Governor McGeehan has had a very frosty relationship with Governor Little and has gotten herself into a place where she doesn't have all that many duties assigned by the governor. And so what is it that she's going to be doing between now and January that she needs to spend down the rest of the year's worth of the budget? We don't really know, because she hasn't said.
Well, exactly. Clark, you've spoken many times on this program about redistricting. Can you first just tell us very quickly why this happens every 10 years, the importance of it, but then now this new information coming out that the U.S. Supreme Court may be getting involved in Idaho's redistricting?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I feel like in a way that redistricting has kind of become my life over the last year. And almost every time I come on Idaho Matters, I get to talk about it. But really quickly, redistricting, it's kind of an intimidating concept. It's political. But really what you have to think about it is, is it happens every 10 years. It happens in states all across the country. It's required by the U.S. Constitution and the Idaho Constitution. And when we talk about redistricting, all that we're really talking about is dividing up and redrawing political boundaries, which in Idaho's case includes our legislative district boundaries and our congressional district boundaries. We're redrawing those based on the latest U.S. Census Bureau population data. So if you think back to the 2020 U.S. Census, we all filled out those questionnaires that came to our homes a couple of years ago. That information was all compiled and released. And then last year, Idaho had this bipartisan redistricting commission, three Republicans, three Democrats, who traveled around the state gathering public information, and they used map software and 2020 census data to draw these new legislative and congressional districts. And the idea is to make the districts as close to the same size as possible. You can kind of think of it as putting together a puzzle piece and solving a math problem at the same time. And it gets complicated, right? Idaho has 35 legislative districts in 44 counties. And so those don't add up. And so already there's some tension and some difficulty there. But Idaho approved its redistricting plan in November of 2021 for both the congressional and the legislative districts. Everybody knew there were going to be challenges based on our history with redistricting, based on the political nature of it. And the Idaho Supreme Court, in two different rulings in January and February, actually upheld Idaho's redistricting plan, which put the plan in effect. And when we voted in our primary elections this year on May 17th, those elections were based on these new redistricting maps that were created and were upheld by the Idaho Supreme Court. The latest news is this week, Ada County Prosecutor's Office filed a petition asking the U.S. Supreme Court to go back and review the Idaho Supreme Court ruling that upheld our redistricting plan. And the U.S. Supreme Court has not signaled either way whether or not they're going to take a look at Idaho's plan. But Ada County, led by Commissioners Ryan Davidson, Kendra Kenyon, and Rod Beck, who originally opposed this redistricting plan all the way back in November, are continuing to oppose the redistricting plan and are trying to get it in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the highest court in the land. I don't really know if the Supreme Court will take this up or look at it, but what I do know is if they did take it up, and if for some reason they did throw out Idaho's redistricting plan, it could get really, really messy because, like I just talked about, we had our most recent primary elections based on these new maps. And so the reason that redistricting is important is it affects who can run for which offices. It affects who represents you and your neighbors in the legislature and in Congress and who you can vote for. And like I said, it happens every 10 years. It's all about, we know that population affects big changes. Idaho is one of the fastest growing states in the country over the last 10 years. And so what redistricting does is takes that new population data and we use that to redraw all of our political boundaries with the idea that the populations of the political boundaries will be as close to equal as possible. It's kind of that principle of one person, one vote. And there's other goals as well, trying to keep counties together, trying to keep cities together, trying to keep what they call communities of interest together. And that could be anything from a school district to a neighborhood to a Native American Indian reservation. And so it's an important process that's been going on all throughout the last year. It really did look like it was settled and finalized when the Idaho Supreme Court upheld the redistricting plan in January and February. But now Ada County is making, I think, kind of one last effort trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to look at this because Ada County was concerned about the way Ada County was drawn up and was divided up. Parts of Ada County, which is this fast-growing population center, were carved out and were put together in some cases with less populated, more rural areas from neighboring counties, like I think Canyon County or maybe even Jim County, which includes Emmett. Interesting stuff. I don't know whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court will take a look at this, but a change this week, and Ada County is continuing to challenge and hopes for a review of this.
And Gemma?
So, Clark. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
If I could throw in, too, that Clark has done a great job of covering this. He's you know, probably the best expert in Idaho on this subject, it's worth noting that Idaho probably has the best redistricting process in the country. We have a truly independent and bipartisan, three Democrats and three Republicans that are chosen independent of the legislature. There's input from the political parties, but those members are chosen independently, and it's not through a legislative process. So if they're going to argue on legal grounds or legal shenanigans, they're probably going to have a tough sledding on that front, because Idaho's system is not like other states where there's room for political machinations and shenanigans.
Right. And that's, I guess, what I'm confused about then, Clark, is that Ada County, what are they trying to say? I mean, that Ada County should be like its own little, separate district. I mean, because with that said, then basically so much of the political power would be in the hands of potentially one district.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I wasn't able to talk with the Ada County commissioners this week, but I do think that it's a political objection. When they originally launched their first concerns in November. So we do know that because of the size of Ada County and because we need 35 districts, Ada County was going to have to be divided up one way or the other. Mm. We know that it was going to have to be divided up because it's so large and because the ideal population of each legislative district is like 52 or 54,000 people. If you just take the state's overall population and divide it into 35. But I think it's political reasons here is where the challenge is coming from. Back in November, when they first raised objections, the Ada County commissioners said that they think that this map should be thrown out because it divided the state of Idaho more times than some of the public maps that were submitted. That was one of the aspects of this redistricting process. There was some mapping software, and they actually allowed members of the public to create their own maps and submit them for consideration. And so one of the things that Ada County Commissioner said is the plan that was approved by the commissioners divided up the state of Idaho either 7 or 8 different ways, whereas you have these maps from the public that divided it one less time. But the trade-off is if you divide the counties one less time, the difference in population between the legislative districts gets greater. The difference in population becomes more significant, which is something the commissioners wanted to avoid. Also, in their argument asking for the U.S. Supreme Court to review this, they felt that the Idaho Supreme Court improperly deferred to the Redistricting Commission to decide. But I don't know. It was a unanimous ruling from the Idaho Supreme Court regarding the legislative map, saying that it did not break state law and it didn't break constitutional requirements. And so it'll be interesting to see if this is taken up and what the arguments are. I do view it as a political argument made for essentially political purposes here. And redistricting is all about who represents who gets to run for what office in what area. And so it's a very political process. But yeah, I view it as kind of a political argument. But because of the numbers, because of the population growth, we know that Idaho counties had to be divided. And we know that Ada County had to be divided one way or the other. At the end of the day, it looks like the Ada County commissioners do not like the way that the map divided Ada County. And that's what a big part of the objection sounds like.
And I have to wonder, Clark, about whether it's really even practical to challenge a decision that not only has been finalized, but already has taken effect. We already had primary elections based on this new map. We have people who've been nominated in these new districts and they're running in the November election. If the Supreme Court were to uphold this challenge, what would we do? Have to hold our whole primary process over again?
It would be extremely messy. And I don't know that we've ever seen anything like this. We haven't in my time covering the state. Betsy, and that's why I think there's probably going to be a very, very high bar to whether the U.S. Supreme Court would review this or would consider throwing this out. I think there's probably going to be a high bar there, exactly for the reasons that you said. These maps are in place today. We've already held one election based on these maps, and we're gearing up for the November election that'll be here sooner rather than later. And so I imagine there'll be a very high bar to whether the U.S. Supreme Court would review this. And like I tried to point out at the beginning, U.S. Supreme Court has not signaled one way or the other whether they will even take this up.
Mm-hmm. Betsy, you've been doing some reporting in regards to psychiatric and behavioral health. And I want to first talk about a story that you'll be publishing this weekend, and it's in regards to a psychiatric residential treatment facility for youth being under construction. This is so important because we haven't had something like this in the state of Idaho in quite some time.
Yeah, and this is exactly the gap in services in Idaho that was identified by the Idaho Behavioral Health Council, that there are different levels of services for youth who are undergoing mental health issues. And the very highest level, acute hospitalization, we have that. The one right below that, long-term psychiatric residential care, we don't have any. And so at any one time, 100 Idaho kids have been sent out of state for this type of treatment, far from their families, far from the transition they need back home with their caregivers and their families once they're released. They've been sent as far away as Georgia. There was even a story that the health and welfare director, Dave Jepson, told about a young man who was at a hospital emergency department, and they were looking for a placement for him. And there was no medical reason for him to remain in the hospital's emergency department, but they couldn't find a placement. He stayed there for 3 months.
Well, oh my goodness.
The Behavioral Health Council has a plan for addressing the entire continuum of care for behavioral health, and it includes some funding to help establish this missing link, the PRTF, Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility, in each of three regions of the state. But at the same time, there's a private effort that's been going on, and I do have a story that'll be coming out in Sunday's Idaho Press about this, and it's the Idaho Youth Ranch, which has been serving troubled youth in Idaho since 1953. And they closed their old ranch in Rupert about 7 years ago and launched into a process to see how they could best serve the needs of troubled youth in Idaho. And after a multi-year process and feasibility studies, they decided that they were going to build a PRTF, a really significant one, and it's in Canyon County. And so this will be a 64-bed long-term psychiatric residential treatment facility for youth that also, on the same campus, it's a 253-acre parcel, will include a full-time year-round school, all kinds of different facilities, including what they've already built there, an equine therapy facility with a big indoor riding arena. This is a gorgeous piece of property that has forests and streams and ponds, and it'll get the kids out in nature. It'll serve 100 kids a year. And they are already 1 year into construction on this and are anticipating opening in the summer of 2023 and admitting the first kids. And here's the really remarkable thing. In order to build this, the Idaho Youth Ranch did private fundraising, and they have raised $27 million. And but $150,000 of that was from within Idaho. It's from individuals, foundations, and corporations. And they are really excited about this project and getting it open to help Idaho youth. It's kind of the same vision that their founders had back in 1953 when they appealed to Congress and got a federal land grant to buy some sagebrush property 12 miles out a dirt road outside of Rupert to build their ranch, their youth ranch. And so it's a really interesting piece coming online at the same time that the state is trying to address a whole array of behavioral health needs. And it kind of dovetails into something else that's happening this weekend, Jim. And I don't know if you were going to get to this, but I have a story that will be in tomorrow's Idaho Press about the new 988 crisis and suicide prevention hotline. And so this is a national deal that's been in the works for years, both in Idaho and across the nation, where we are transitioning as of Saturday, right after the stroke of midnight, that it'll be like 911 for mental health. If there's a behavioral health crisis or a suicide call, instead of calling 911, you'll just call 988 and you'll get crisis responders. And there's a whole array of services that will be mobilized if you call this. But the number one most important one, according to those who've been operating the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline for the last 10 years, the one that helps most callers is just someone, a trained crisis responder, to talk to them, to talk to the caller and help them de-escalate and be safe. Beyond that, they can be referred to a crisis center, and we now have crisis centers in every region of the state. They're free. People can just walk in. They don't need an appointment 24/7. They can stay for a few minutes or up to 24 hours. And there's also mobile crisis response units that can be dispatched, just like if you were calling 911 and getting the police to come out. Instead of police coming out to a behavioral health crisis, there could be trained clinicians who come out. Now, we don't have that capability 24/7 in the whole state as of yet, but it is ramping up. And here in Ada County, those mobile crisis response units are available from 8 a.m. to midnight, 7 days a week. And this is really significant. So when people are in crisis and they need help, as of tomorrow in this state, they can just call 988.
That is so critically important, Betsy, because we know that this has been such an issue, even when it comes to getting that 911 call, right? And police being called out and sometimes not knowing how to de-escalate. So hopefully this will, you know, help that.
Yeah, and we have had some really stunning and horrifying incidents here in Idaho over the years where the police came out for someone who was in crisis and the person ended up getting shot and killed. And, you know, that's obviously not the outcome that anybody wants to, you know, help a 16-year-old kid or a person who is going through something, deal with their problems and move on and get back to where they can be a productive member of society. And so this has been a very high priority for our state. The Idaho Behavioral Health Council has brought together all three branches of state government, and they've been working on this for 3 years. The pandemic slowed them down a little bit, but they've got the courts, they've got the legislature, they've got the executive branch. And this year, the legislature authorized $66 million towards these initiatives, and it should make an appreciable difference. There will be various types of facilities, community behavioral health clinics opening all over the state over the next year or two, all kinds of things changing and happening to try to address this better. So that if somebody has a mental health crisis, we don't throw them in jail or take them to
or
the
worse.
Emergency room or do something that actually doesn't provide the services they need and maybe traumatizes them more.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I apologize for not getting to everything, but quite a bit to talk about today. As Betsy mentioned, that that service, 988, will go into effect tomorrow, Saturday. My thanks to Clark Corbin, Betsy Russell, and Scott McIntosh.